Hey, everybody. Welcome to Necromaniacs, Episode 3. I'm here with my good friend, Mike Scandato.
Hey, everybody. What's up?
And this is Mike Hill. Hey, Mike, are you a coffee drinker?
Yes. I became one literally 5 to 7 years ago. I drink coffee every morning. Not so much more than the morning, but every morning I have iced coffee for like the past 7 years of my life.
Well, knowing that, you really need to try a Savage Gold coffee.
Yes. I've heard about this Savage Gold coffee. Tell me more.
Yeah, Savage Gold is it's my my new coffee brand. And, you know, it tastes good. I'm not going to try to shove it down your throat. I don't want to convince you if you're not into it. But, yeah, go over to www.savagegoldcoffee.com and pick up a pound. And I do sell full pounds because if you buy something, you know, like another coffee from one of these other companies, you get a 12-pound bag. 12-ounce bag.
And they sell it as a pound. Interesting.
Well, they don't really. They kind of slip it by you that you're only getting 12 ounces. But I give you the full 16. So you're getting, good bang for your buck.
See, you're not getting hoodwinked either. I have not even tried the coffee yet, everybody. So I'm not going to come on here and blow smoke up your butt.
Yeah.
So I am going to try it soon.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling I will like it.
It's brand new, man. We just launched last week, and just trying to get the word out there. But that's one of our quote unquote sponsors for the show.
Yes, Savage Gold Coffee.
All right. So what do we got on the docket for this episode, Mike?
Well, it's been a little while. We're both busy in our personal lives. And I just would like to say we're going to come back with some more frequency now and a bit more of a reinstated commitment. But we're going to kick things off with a movie from 2013 entitled World War Z.
Yeah, that was based on the Max Brooks short story collection that came out several years ago.
Yeah, it's kind of it's weird. I mean, to some people, it is kind of a short story collection. I had trouble with the book, I must say. Maybe I wasn't really used to reading things done in that kind of more like random like style of the way it was written, kind of like these little, not vignettes, but just like these little kind of bursts of different points of the story, so to speak, instead of a linear straight story.
Yeah, I enjoyed the novel or short story collection. Initially, I didn't get on board because of, the zombie survival guide.
Right.
Which, to me, seemed a little campy and
a little goofy, yeah.
Seemed like a little goofy, and I take zombie fiction very seriously, so so it was a little turned off initially. But I ended up reading it and pretty much thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, it actually was ahead of the curve, if you think about it. It came out kind of before the big zombie explosion, actually. It was almost... some people think of it as something that helped kind of kick it off in a way, actually, because the book got very popular because it's written in a serious tone of an unbelievable topic, so to speak. But it was written very like, hey, this is what you have to do in case this happens, and this could really happen. So,
well, one of the things I really like is, with that in mind, is in general fiction or horror fiction where you really only have to make one assumption. And then everything else is logical and makes sense. And that's what I kind of feel like Max Brooks did with his World War Z mythos, is that you have to make one assumption and then, everything just sort of falls in line after that. So that brings us to this movie, World War Z, the theatrical version of Max Brooks' masterpiece here.
Right. It was directed by Mark Forster. And Brad Pitt, as well as, aside from being the star, was one of the producers, along with three other producers, Dee Dee Gardner, Jeremy Kleiner, and Ian Bryce. One thing I was talking about before we got started about the movie that I got a kick out of was the amount of money spent on this movie, which, according to, IMDb and Wikipedia, was $190 million. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Probably the most expensive horror film ever made.
Yeah, and it's almost counterintuitive because you think about like some of the greatest zombie films or any horror film. Some of the greatest horror films were made on shoestring budgets. Mm. So like a big, huge budget like that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a great film.
Right, exactly. And you could make the case for that's kind of what happened here where it was a little too ambitious, I almost feel like. I really enjoyed the high quality of the movie overall. I think it was shot very well. The story itself, a comic book guy, J. Michael Straczynski, is a co-writer. Pretty good story. The acting, I don't know. I don't hate Brad Pitt. And I think Mirelle Enos is a great actress from The Killing, a show that we both love. Yep. And the other performances in the movie I thought were great. I just feel like overall, maybe they didn't have a good sense of what they wanted this movie to be. It was not a rated R film. So it was almost something that the whole family could go see, about a zombie movie the whole family could see that stars Brad Pitt, and Brad Pitt helped make it. I mean, there's a lot of selling points to mainstream media there. But I feel like it was just too ambitious of a movie with a lot of crazy like locations, Israel, England, the Middle East. They just, it's a very large scope, in the movie itself. And I feel like if they kind of maybe scaled it down a bit and kind of put more of a focus on one aspect instead of kind of trying to be maybe three or four movies in once, it might have turned out a little different.
Well, for me, one of my favorite entries into like the zombie genre was obviously Night of the Living Dead, which took place basically in one house. Mm-hmm. I mean, to have like this big
one
epic,
night,
this big sprawling scope, I think is a little counter to what makes actually a good zombie film, because I think smaller stories actually come off better where you have like a smaller group of people, characters, you start, and it's a more claustrophobic sort of vibe to it. This movie, like, I think started really strong.
Yes,
though,
I like the opening scene in New York.
It was Philly.
Philly. I'm sorry. Yeah, with Brad Pitt and the family in the car, and I thought it was cool. But this movie has the highly debatable running zombie in it. And in this case, it's not even just running zombies. They're kind of like practically acrobatic zombies at certain points. I mean, they're very fast, and they're very there's a lot of movement going on. And when they get together in bunches, it's like this big swarming mass. And it's just, some of that didn't look too great, I have to say, for a movie that spent so much money. I feel like, I don't know, some of those big group zombie visuals looked very fake to me, but...
Yeah. Mm. But one of the things that was said earlier on, these were, in the film, there was the doctor, the guy who ends up shooting himself in the head by accident, mm-hmm. who supposedly had the answer to the whole thing over in the plane. He was saying that, the biggest serial killer are, viruses. So these were, like, viral zombies. Like, they weren't...
Yeah.
Technically, they weren't, like, the living dead. Mm-hmm. So there was this concept of the virus trying to propagate itself and using these bodies as hosts. So they were, in a way, expendable as long as, the virus itself moved from place to... from host to host. So that's... They're trying to portray this sort of image of, like, this sea of components that made up this, larger consciousness sort of acting together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an interesting idea, but do I think that's like a compelling idea as opposed to just like a shambling animated corpse? Like, I don't know if I'm convinced that that's really the scariest type of zombie, really.
Yes. I mean, some people were like, well, this isn't necessarily even a zombie movie. It's an infection movie. It's an infected movie. Kind of like, 28 days later, 28 weeks later. I can see that. I mean, there were points in the story where people did indeed die and then got back up and were walking around. I mean, there was definitely actual real zombie, transmutations or whatever the word you can use. But there was, it was kind of a mix of that plus just, again, just tons, hundreds, thousands of zombies just already kind of running around, already existing, and I don't know. It got to be visually a kind of a mess, I thought, at times. I don't know. I mean, the movie made $540 million worldwide for a $190 million budget, which means, yes, it was a success. Not really so sure if this would warrant some kind of sequel, but of course, obviously, the ending kind of left it up for a sequel because... the problem, so to speak, is still very much there at the end of the film, and you know, it becomes something that they have to deal with as a way of life. You know, basically fighting the zombies.
You know, props to Brad Pitt for seeing this project through, though.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, he, you know, In as he's gotten older, I've become a bigger fan of his. You know?
I would say so too. Yeah, yes. I mean, he lobbied to get this movie done, and some of his own money was made to direct the film. And I know there was a lot of reshoots, and it took a while for this to actually finally hit the theaters as it did last year. I remember hearing for a long time that the movie was in development, and that Brad Pitt was attached to it. And I was like, wow, like, you know, who knew that Brad Pitt was a horror fan, but again, maybe that had nothing to do with it. Again, it's just the book was a hit, which is really where this all kind of lies from the huge success of the book.
Yeah, you know, I started liking Brad Pitt a little bit more around the time Fight Club came out, you know, and Snatch and all those films.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, like, he's a guy that a lot of men, you know, feel uncomfortable saying that they like his work because he's such, like, a pretty guy, you know what I mean?
Right.
He's like one of those cats who, like, make regular guys like me and you a little bit uncomfortable, I think, you know?
Yeah, I think I'm definitely past that now.
Yeah.
And his roles are more diverse, and he doesn't have really anything to prove to anybody, I feel like. He just makes the movies that he wants to make, pretty much, and stars in what he wants to star in, and his name still has a nice cachet to it, and he still brings people to the theater, which is the other most important thing. Again, had this not been in his hands, either being in the starring side or the producer side, who knows, you know? I mean, this movie became a very big hit. One of the interesting aspects of the movie, I thought the music was very good, and it's Marco Beltrami, whose name is attached to hundreds of movies over the years.
There you go.
And I actually like some of the music a lot. Actually, I would consider grabbing this the soundtrack if they did a special vinyl for it, which is what they're doing for many movies lately. But yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say I love the movie. I had some problems with it, but I definitely didn't hate the movie. I'm kind of like a nice in between with a nod to like than this, you know, closer to like than dislike.
I wouldn't recommend it necessarily. I didn't dislike it, but I didn't love it, you know. And the thing about it that really sort of put me at odds was that the movie was definitely not made for horror fans.
Right.
You know, it wasn't a hard R.
No,
it was a PG-13 film.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I was saying earlier, it was almost like a disaster movie. It was like a drama action disaster film rather than a horror film, which is kind of interesting. But again, you feel it and I feel as well that the zombie film and the zombie genre definitely works a little better in maybe tighter quarters and smaller scope. Absolutely.
And also there wasn't enough like conflict in there necessarily. I mean, you know how like in all, I mean, once again, just the same formulaic zombie, you know, trip is, you know, the what people do to each other is worse. Mm-hmm. And that's always been the case,
right,
man.
Right.
Like, there's always been a big conflict between humans.
Mm-hmm.
And the zombies are just sort of this, like, backdrop of, like, you know, danger that's always around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even going back to Night of the Living Dead, it was like the sort of embroiled conflict between the people stuck together that actually led,
like,
to the downfall.
The real monsters, as it turns out, were the people who, you know, at the end of the film, shooting up everybody. And, you know, of course, there was a definite racial undertone in The Night of the Living Dead at the end. And, of course, in almost all of Romero's films, there is a different type of story at play, whether it be about, like, society or the rich versus the poor. Like, you know, there's always a little something more to it. And even in the title of The Walking Dead, whereas you would immediately would think, oh, they're referring to zombies. No, they're referring to the walking dead, the people left behind who have to deal with all this crap. So, yeah, there was kind of really none of that in this movie.
And that's something I noticed right away, is that there was almost like a lack of suspense, a lack of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
The action was there somewhat, but there was the only real suspense in that film. The only, like, you know, jump moments were in the beginning when they were in that apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
in New York.
That was a good scene when they were in New Jersey.
Yeah,
that was actually a very good scene. I like that a lot. I would have liked to have seen maybe a little more of that as they went from different country to different country. And it got more involved with the military. And again, it just, you know, I don't think a zombie film necessarily needs all of that when it comes to movies. A book is one thing. And a lot of people felt this was kind of like, you know, an unfilmable kind of book, really, because the book is also goes to a lot of different places and tells a lot of different stories. But, you know, in this day and age, every successful book becomes a movie, so it's pretty much inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, the book only could have really been like a series of films or TV show, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, because there's so many different facets to it. But right. then, you know, there's Walking Dead already, so I don't think that would succeed necessarily.
No, exactly. And Walking Dead obviously has the lock on any zombie television, I'm sure.
If they had just stayed in Jersey, I think the film would have been good.
Yes.
I mean, honestly, it's like movie. They didn't need to go to Glasgow and like Budapest and Israel or any of those places.
Right.
They just could have hung out like in the state of New Jersey and had a really compelling story there.
I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, with the kid who they took with them, who kind of
got lost by the wayside.
Yeah, they kind of forgot about that little kid. It was kind of strange. I mean, you know, again, yeah, not something I would recommend, but maybe not as bad as some of your really, you know, horror-heavy friends said it was either, right? I mean, that's kind of how I feel about it.
No, it wasn't miserable.
Not a waste of time, I don't think. No. Has some enjoyable moments, some good acting, good music, shot very nice. Not a complete waste of your 2 hours of life.
The beginning, very good. Like I was saying earlier, I just want to go back to that. Just the, you know, like, that paranoia that anyone who grew up or lives in like a major city, when you're stuck in traffic, there's gridlock, you know, there's like, you know, some police situation going on and you know, that sort of rising panic when you can see people running in the opposite direction. That really was effective, I thought, mm-hmm. you know? And, that was like the first, 15 minutes of the film, I think, were great.
Yeah.
And then that was probably the highlight. Declined after that.
Totally.
Yeah.
We'll see if Brad Pitt dives into the horror pool once again with better success.
Some related horror news is for those of you who enjoy horror soundtracks, the soundtrack for Beyond the Black Rainbow is coming out in September. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a joint release by Death Waltz Records and Jag Jaguar. So
yeah, Death Waltz has put out some winners, and almost pretty much everything they put out becomes out of print, which is nice. I'm sure this will do well. This movie, it's a movie me and Mike been championed for over a year and a half, 2 years now, and it's kind of growing actually. This movie, it was a small, creepy film.
Yeah,
I don't even. It's so hard to describe.
I can't even describe it.
It's
really
very hard to describe. Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Great soundtrack though.
It's like it's a movie that, you know, in another world was made in like 1980, 81, but in reality it was made, you know, now in the 2000s. And, very cool, minimal kind of synth music in it.
Yeah, the release is like, there's a deluxe and like a, you know, like a regular release. You know, one of them is, comes with a DVD. I believe it's a DVD. It comes mm-hmm. with the film mm-hmm. and the, you know, the vinyl and then download card.
Oh, nice.
And the other one is the vinyl and the download card. So I already have the Blu-ray, so I'll probably get the regular.
Yes, me too. I tell you, the horror vinyl thing is still as hot as it's been for the past year or so. And, I mean, I'm just looking forward to the stuff that hasn't hit vinyl yet coming out, like maybe the first Friday the 13th, which I understand is in the works.
Nice.
And maybe Nightmare on Elm Street. Just a few kind of more popular gems that, you know, they haven't really mined for vinyl yet, probably for financial or legal reasons. There's no Cannibal Holocaust vinyl yet. You know, there's a few things that are kind of surprising. There's a Make Them Die Slowly Cannibal Pharaoh one that just came out, actually, about 2 months ago, which I think also might be gone by now. You know, they make these in limited quantities, anywhere from 500 to 2,000. And, they usually sell out very fast.
Yeah, Death Waltz always does a great job mm-hmm. with, you know, the artwork and the whole packaging.
Absolutely. And Mondo, the Texas company, I have almost all their releases. Their very first one was Maniac.
Oh, yeah.
It was the Maniac reissue. And then they went on to do the vinyl version of the Maniac remake as well. And both of those are both worth a pretty penny.
Yeah, man. And that soundtrack, the Maniac remake soundtrack.
Fantastic.
Is like something I have I listen to regularly.
It's yeah, great. No, it's yeah, very good. It's almost like a nice companion to the original Jay Chataway music. It's like a almost in some ways it's like just like the modern equivalent yeah. in some ways. It's kind of interesting.
And it's not even really that modern sounding.
No, it's not. It's only what I mean that only in the time
yeah.
sense.
Yeah, it's like it definitely has a heavily eighties synth yeah. kind of vibe to it.
Yeah. Absolutely. So yeah, more stuff to spend your money on, kids. Horror vinyl.
So that brings us to our next film, which is the Old Boy remake.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I have to say, I think I heard that Spike Lee, a director, I have to say off the bat, I like Spike Lee's movies. I like most of his movies. I thought Malcolm X is fantastic. Do the Right Thing is a fantastic movie. He's a Brooklyn guy, self-made guy. I have some, good amount of respect for Spike Lee. However, when I heard he was going to remake the 2003 Korean film Old Boy, I was kind of scratching my head because anyone who's seen that movie or knows about that movie, it is an epic film that mixes drama, horror, and action.
Yeah.
And it is pretty much a genuine original, I would say, this movie. I've never really seen a movie quite like it. Shocking, violent. It's just like everything you would want almost in a genre film thrown into this one movie, kind of movie, controversial, yeah. You know. And Spike Lee, again, no stranger to controversy, always in some kind of trouble, maybe for his big mouth or some of his subject matter. So it's like, okay, well, maybe it makes a little bit of sense that he wants to do this movie. But ultimately, I just feel like he was way over his damn head making this movie.
Yeah, I mean, the movie, in my opinion, didn't work at all. And it's not due to bad acting or anything. Mm-hmm. I just think that, you know, that movie, the original Old Boy, was such an over-the-top, very controversial, mm-hmm. very extreme film that could only really have been made in Asia, really.
Yeah, no, really.
You know, maybe Gaspar Noé could make
exactly.
A film like that.
I couldn't even... When, after I'd seen it, I'm like, wow, there's nothing I could compare this movie to.
So for Gaspar Noé.
Right, it's its own movie. It's its own everything, the original Old Boy. That's how good a movie it is. Like, I that's how much I enjoy the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like... Okay, Spike Lee was obviously a fan of the movie, like so many other people were. Most movie people love the hell out of the original Old Boy. And I guess, you know, I believe he kind of lobbied to make this movie and put together a good cast. Josh Brolin is a great actor. Elizabeth Olsen is a fantastic new actress. I mean, in tons of good movies of the past few years. Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, which is a movie that I think is even worthy of us discussing right here on Necromaniacs. That's how good a movie that is. So, like, on paper...
Sam Jackson.
Yes, Sam Jackson, you know, Spike Lee standby, always puts in a good job in any role he does, in my opinion. I like seeing Sam Jackson on screen. On paper, it sounded very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the plot file, if you haven't seen the original, it's, mm-hmm. they're similar, but they're not exactly the same.
Yeah, some people were saying that they were kind of almost looking forward to Spike Lee adding something to the overall story, but he actually does not.
He took away,
He kind of took away a few. Yeah. Yes, he did. Definitely in terms of the action sequences, there are not nearly as many, I feel like, epic fight scenes as there were in the first, as there is in the second. And I just feel like the execution of the fight scenes in the Spike Lee film is very poor.
Yeah.
And it's very uncomfortable to watch the fight scenes. You have to understand what I'm saying. As you're watching the film, and if you've seen the original, or maybe if you haven't even seen the original, I feel like there's no kind of believability. There's no, like, intensity. It was almost like... comical, not in the good way comical.
Yeah.
Some of the fight and scenes of violence.
It was too campy.
Campy, right, exactly. Yeah. Like watching almost like a Batman
like a
fight
Batman,
scene from the 60s
like an
TV
Adam West
show.
Batman style
yeah,
fight
I mean,
scene, yeah.
And in the original, make no mistake, it is violent and it's bloody. And there is some comedy in the original, but I don't know. I just feel like Spike Lee probably had a lot of good intentions with this film, but I think not every director can make every genre of film.
I agree.
Even the best directors, right?
Yeah.
Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island is horrible. I'm sorry. It's a ridiculous movie. It's not a great horror movie. Martin Scorsese should not do horror movies ever again, in my opinion.
No.
He's not a horror guy. Just like I don't think, say... Dario Argento should do a serious drama film with no horror in it whatsoever. I think it would fail miserably. Spike Lee should probably leave heavy action fight cult movies alone.
Yeah,
I don't think he should be tackling any other movies like this ever again. Again, he can be the biggest fan in the world. Just because you're the biggest fan in the world doesn't mean you can do it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And I feel like that's kind of a prime example of this movie, taking nothing away from Brolin or Olsen, who I thought were very, very good in the movie.
Yeah, also the campiness in you know, in those Asian films. I mean, you know, the violence is a little cartoony in the original Old Boy, but all like that's sort of like a standard in a lot of like Asian action films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even Takashi Miike is like one of the darkest filmmakers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's something always like a little bit blackly comic about it.
In Audition, there's definitely moments aside from all the uncomfortableness, there are moments of comedy in that film, especially in the beginning half of the film. Absolutely.
But in the remake, in Spike's remake, the comedy is like out of place almost. It's very forced.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, some of the dialogue was a little forced as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just ultimately the whole thing really didn't really work for me.
I almost feel like maybe in a different director's hands, an American remake of this movie might have fared a bit differently. You know, I mean, because since I've seen the Spike Lee movie, now I can see it in my head, the same kind of story happening in America, maybe minus some of the immense kind of fighting, but the story itself, the story of a man in captivity for 20 years and being framed for murder, like there are parts of the story that do translate well to you know, in the American version. But again, it just comes down to the, I think, the director. And if the public isn't buying that this director of a completely different type of film is doing something that's, you know, new, then it's like, you know what? Then it's a failure. I feel like, I don't think anybody came out of there saying, wow, Spike Lee can do anything now, can't he? I just really don't think that happened.
The only parts I really liked was when Sam Jackson was in on the screen, man. Because he just is, you know, even in RoboCop, man, he was
he's
awesome, kinda, you know.
They say, choose the scenery, as they say.
Yeah,
he's
totally.
He owns everything he does, and just, you know, I mean, some people accuse it a little bit of the overacting kind of thing, whatever.
It works though for him.
It does, right? Like, you know? I'm enjoying when he's there doing his fucking thing, you know, exactly.
Like when they're cutting, there's a scene where they're like, you know, he's like cutting, you know, he's going to cut his head off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it, just the over the top, he's like, ah, motherfucker.
Yeah,
you know, it's just like perfect Sam Jackson shit, you know? But the storyline itself too, which basically in summary, it's like Josh Brolin plays this guy, right? You know, sort of like a middle management dude in a company, kind of a piece of shit,
right? Womanizer.
They show him pissing in a doorway,
right?
You know,
exactly.
This sort of shabby kind of sort
of
guy,
mm-hmm.
drinking on the job. He fucks up this deal with the black guy from Oz.
Yeah,
I love that dude. He was also in the Wire.
Yeah, I can't think of his name right now.
He's awesome. He plays like McDaniels in The Wire, whatever that dude's
familiar
name
face.
Is. That guy rules. But he's like some client. He tries to roll on his wife. he slaps him up, and then you know, then the guy gets abducted by you know, this unknown person.
Yeah.
Some weird, like, European guy with, like, a weird accent.
Yeah, and, I mean, what did you think of that part? What did you think of, like, the man behind everything part?
It turns out that actually that guy who was the man behind everything, you know, the stranger, whatever we want to call him, he actually was his name is Shartlow Copley.
Mm-hmm.
He's a South African, you know, writer,
Shartlow
actor,
Copley,
sort of guy. And he's, he actually had something to do with writing and directing the film. He was like partially the writer of this as
Interesting.
Well. Interesting. But yeah, that guy, I don't know, man. Like, he was trying to do, like, I mean, I never seen him before, so who knows what he's like
right,
in other films.
Yeah, he did that sleazy European of unknown origin kind of role, you don't know what he's all about or what he's up to, and you know he's up to no good, and you know he's no good, but you can't quite put your finger on it.
But that whole plot element was very shaky, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because it turns out that Josh Brolin's character went to some prep school, and there was a girl there, and like he was observing her getting, you know, getting fucked by her dad.
Right.
And it turns out that, you know, her dad was like a professor at the school.
At the college.
And he was like diddling this guy, the European.
Yes.
Who turns out, you know.
Yeah, the father was diddling not only his daughter, but it was diddling his son as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely up the sleaze quote there for a Spike Lee movie even.
Definitely.
You know. But, yeah, to exact that amount of revenge on a guy
who... Such an elaborate scheme, too.
Yeah, who may have caught your sister having sex with your father. It was just, I don't know. Yeah, maybe a bit much.
Well, it turns out the dad kills himself.
Right.
And then the whole love triangle that he was enjoying through all of his younger years crashes to a halt.
Yes.
And he's unhappy. So as a result of his unhappiness...
Which he blames on Josh Brolin.
He blames on Josh Brolin's character. He devises this plan to abduct him isolate him, frame him for murdering his wife,
mm-hmm.
and then sort of deceiving him into thinking that this other girl is his daughter.
It's his daughter,
surviving
right.
daughter.
Yes.
And then manipulates the situation where he, Josh Brolin's character, whatever the fuck his name is in the movie,
mm-hmm.
ends up fornicating with his real daughter.
His own real daughter,
which
yes.
is, a you know, similar to the original plot.
Yes, exactly.
But now here's the major departure. And this is, I don't care, it's a spoiler alert.
Yeah, if you're listening to a podcast about movies, there's going to be spoilers.
Spoilers. In the original film, the character chooses to continue having sex with
yes,
his daughter.
He doesn't care anymore. Yeah. At that point, he feels like he's just been through so much.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
In the American Spike Lee remake, you know, there's
the
like
shame,
this,
the yeah, wave
the shame,
of shame,
like Christian guilt.
Right, and, he, and just the vomiting and the whole nine yards
yeah.
and guilt. And
he has to, like, walk away from the whole situation
right,
and never
right.
see her again. And
mm-hmm.
there just isn't that, like, amoral
no.
like, thing going on, which I think really needed to happen in this film.
Yeah, yeah. It would have been even more shocking. I do think the 10 people that saw this movie, the people that may not have seen the original, some people were probably pretty shocked by what happened in the end. Maybe weren't expecting that kind of
yeah.
twist, you know?
Yeah.
And it must have been interesting to be that person with having no knowledge and just going into this movie as, say, oh, it's a new Spike Lee movie, you know?
True. But you know what, though? Like, incest is, like, commonplace in films. I mean, look at Game of Thrones.
Yeah, the whole thing. Is,
yeah.
It's
like incest isn't shocking anymore. I mean, it's a shocking, horrible thing, but, like...
But it doesn't have the luggage it used to carry, as
yeah,
you say.
Yeah, totally.
It kind of doesn't. It's
nope.
kind of weird. I mean...
Yeah.
Sure, in most social circles, absolutely, it carries a lot of baggage and luggage. But in the movie world, the TV world, it's kind of slipping, I almost feel like.
I mean, to be clear,
right.
I'm in no way
no.
You know, saying it's okay to go out
absolutely
and touch kids
not.
Or like
no,
have,
no,
have
no.
sex with your family members.
No,
but
not
like,
at all. That goes
but
that
in my book, that's kind of like unsavory still.
Of
but
course.
I'm talking about in art.
In film and in TV... I don't know. I almost feel it's either not happening at all, or when it does, it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, who cares? Yeah. Right, right?
So I was disappointed that he didn't continue having sex with his daughter.
Well, we can get some hard numbers for the film. The budget was $30 million for this movie. And, oh boy, it made $4,861.
Still?
$4 million it made. Yeah.
Huh.
Almost $5
million.
It cost $30 to make it. It made not even $5 million. That is a huge failure.
Yeah.
That is a very big failure. It pretty much, we were saying earlier, I feel like Spike Lee has a decent amount of fans that go see his movies. Apparently, these people didn't even go see this movie. It's like unbelievable what happened with this film.
I kind of didn't even know it came out, honestly.
It was in theaters. It was in mainstream theaters. I believe literally maybe 2 weeks. It was gone very fast. And the promotion for it was gone very fast as well. It was not maybe because of the subject matter, maybe the studio didn't fully believe in this movie after they'd seen it and they knew the story about it. But yeah, it was a colossal failure and one of Spike Lee's biggest failures, actually, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'm a sort of men's on men's fan of his work. I mean, uh-huh. I like a handful of his movies.
Right.
You know, I like Clockers. I thought that was awesome.
Yes, yes.
You know, Summer of Sam.
Summer of Sam is probably my favorite of his.
That's definitely
my favorite.
Do
the Right Thing, yeah.
Definitely my favorite.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Do the Right Thing was cool.
I liked Malcolm X a lot. It's a good movie.
Yeah.
And I liked, what's that one? The really racially charged one. Hoodwinked or whatever? What's it called? No. The one that was super controversial about, like, the minstrel show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I still don't even know what the hell he was trying to say about that movie.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah, that's a pretty messed up movie. You got to check that one out. But, yeah, I have a funny feeling he may not dip his feet into this pool again. I don't know. You know?
There's also another scene in there where, in the original... You know, that dude devours that live squid.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And there was a nod. There was a nod
to it because Brolin walks into this restaurant and there's like this gigantic squid.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, is he going to do
it? And the camera the camera pauses on the squid and on him, and yeah, that was kind of cool.
You should fucking eat it, man.
Yeah, man.
Why not? That's what I'm saying. Like the original old boy, you know, Park Chan Wook, the South Korean guy.
Who yes. Made it.
Like, he just didn't give a fuck. He went all the way, man.
Oh, yeah.
He went deep. You know what I'm saying? Like, that movie was powerful. Like, the amount of... Like, the power that guy had to have that... To say, look, I want you to eat that live squid.
Yeah.
You know?
It's the original is a mind fuck. It's a great movie. I would recommend anybody see the original. I mean, I would, you know, check it out. I mean, it is... Wild, wild movie available on, you know, DVD and Blu-ray from Tartan. I have the DVD for a long time in my collection. And to a lot of people, my brother John included, he was like, this movie shouldn't even have been dreamed about being remade. It shouldn't have been touched. It's like a sacred movie.
I agree with
that. It's again, to me, it's like a standalone movie. It's like, when you see it, you kind of can really see what I'm talking about, as where you really can't really compare it to much. It is a revenge movie.
Oh, yeah.
But it is unlike any revenge movie you'll probably ever see in your life.
And, you know, and it's on that short list of, there's like that short list of Asian films.
Mm-hmm.
And Old Boy is, you know, Old Boy, Ichi the Killer, Audition, you know, those are like, you know, Battle Royale.
Yes,
like
the upper Asian. Echelon. Yes, exactly.
It's one of those films. Yeah,
in the top five, absolutely.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those films, and it's just like...
Well, I read today, it's funny, we mentioned Audition a few times. Well, it's coming. There's going to be
American... making it?
Yeah. Ooh. Oh, I can't remember. Quick blurb today on one of the horror sites, and oh, yeah. And it's like, haven't we learned anything from Old Boy?
Wow. The one thing
I guess, here's the thing. I could kind of see the American remake, but what are they gonna do to that movie to make it better? There's nothing you can do. I mean, it's a great movie. The whole first hour, it's almost like you're watching like a romantic comedy about a single guy trying to find a woman. And then it goes to hell, literally.
Yeah, totally.
So what are you gonna, like, why even bother? Like, it's just unbelievable, right?
Yeah. I just think that the movie business is getting its ass kicked by TV.
God, absolutely.
We need to make some cash.
That can be a whole other topic in itself, how... The best movies are on television right now, and they're an hour long. I mean, Breaking Bad is one of the biggest... Breaking Bad, True Detective are two of the biggest arguments for the best movies you'll see on TV, you know? Yeah. And they're not movies. So, you know,
they're like an eight-hour movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we talked a lot about True Detective earlier on in the first podcast, I believe, or second one. I think second one. I mean, since it wrapped up and now that DVD and Blu-ray is out, you know, I'm just kind of reading more reviews and more feedback on that. And people just like, wow, man, they're like hungry for a second season and wondering what it's going to be like. And can it even be topped? Like, why should they even bother making a second season?
I almost feel like, why bother? You know, unless it's going to have those same two dudes in it again.
Yeah, I know.
Great characters, you know.
Yes, yes. Nick Pizzolatto, guy, is just, wow, man. I mean, just unbelievable. I mean, he was, you know, a crime writer, fiction writer, you know. Got his script to the right hands, HBO.
As a result of watching that, I read Galveston, one of his novels, and it was great. Dark.
Yeah, I have to get it.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now on the bookshelf. Great movie.
Yeah,
I
can't say enough about how much I like True Detective.
Also, the Olsen girl.
Elizabeth Olsen.
Elizabeth Olsen, man. She's a great actress. She did a great job, but she's naked in that movie quite a bit.
Yes. She, several other of her more smaller indie movies, she's naked as well. And I'm proud to say she is going to be our Scarlet Witch, Michael.
Really?
Yes. She's in The Avengers. Yeah.
Excellent.
So I like that she can go from the gritty, you know, smaller film to a superhero blockbuster.
Maybe she'll be naked in The Avengers.
Maybe she'll be naked in The Avengers. Maybe, you know, yeah.
It's an outstanding choice, man.
Oh, my goodness gracious. No, she is good, and she's a fearless actress, I would say.
You know, back in the 80s, I remember women, it was like you had to take your clothes off in those films. It was like if you were a female actress.
Yeah, you know what?
You were topless, always.
Especially if you were in a drama film, right? Like Kim Basinger back in the day, and... Like, I feel like there was... It almost was kind of expected. Susan Sarandon was naked a lot back in the day. Now it's definitely a bigger deal now. It's like the norm is that, no, you're not going to see her naked. Like, you're not going to see Jennifer Aniston naked. Oh, she's come pretty damn close in
a couple
of
movies. Was she ever
naked? No, but she's... It's this weird almost nudity she's done.
I got to say something really quick about her.
Yes.
I don't really like Jennifer Aniston. I mean, she's a beautiful woman. On screen, I don't really care so much for her. Right. But I saw her in person once in Manhattan.
Really?
And she's quite striking.
See, that's the thing. My Jennifer Aniston story is that I never cared for her throughout the entire 90s.
Mm-hmm.
The whole Friends thing. I like Courtney Cox. That's all I like.
Oh, yeah. I like
always Courtney liked Cox. Her more. Yeah. But in the modern Jennifer Aniston, the last 5-7 years, the post-Brad Pitt stuff, I think she looks fantastic.
Maybe that you know, she got
and I
crazy.
Feel like, oh, that definitely did
she
something
wanted to get
to her upstairs.
She wanted to get crazy after
that. Yeah, I think so. Revenge. I love Angelina Jolie, too. But I feel like Jennifer Aniston looks better now than when she did back on Friends.
Angelina Jolie is just like all
she's
the
pretty
world,
great,
man.
Yeah, I mean, pretty eternally great.
I'm down with her completely, man. You know, and she's crazy too, man.
Yes,
she's like, you know, she's
even
like,
though like the kids and the marriage has kind of made her a little, you know, maybe a little more calmed down. She still definitely gets down. I still think she's crazy.
Oh yeah,
like she's still the crazy girl, you know, at heart. You know,
yeah, definitely.
I mean, she took Brad Pitt away from Jennifer Aniston, so there you go. I mean. She's got powers, no?
I think so, man, for sure.
She's got powers. Pretty much any man probably would have, you know, caved. But anyway, we digress. Sometimes we just talk about, like, man stuff. I don't know. But anyway, yeah. Are we recommending anybody to see Old Boy remake? No.
Hell no.
No, you don't need to see it.
Just watch the original again.
Yes, you know? Watch the original again. And I think Josh Brolin is great. I want to see Josh Brolin in some kind of superhero movie role. I don't know, maybe some kind of villain. I like seeing him on screen. He's fucking tough. He's his personal life is insane as well. So I feel like he's kind of a fun actor.
I would like to see Josh Brolin play a young Charles Bukowski.
You'd say that.
Some of the a Henry Chinaski story. You know, I think that he's got that sort of hard drinking, like, you know, reckless like vibe. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a fan of his. I think he's great.
Diane Lane's husband for many years, and they divorced now. Yeah,
now, Diane Lane.
Diane Lane's finally fantastic, fantastic woman.
Rumblefish.
But supposedly he was, you know, not a good boy. He might have beat her once or twice.
Oh man, really?
Okay. Yeah, I know. But he's had a 30-year career just like she has. I mean, she goes all the way back to Outsiders. He goes all the way back to Goonies. That's the 30-year-old movie, Goonies. Well, next year it's 30 years old.
Wow.
So they've both, you know, been in the business a long time.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, he's a lifer. But and his dad is married to Barbra Streisand. Yeah.
Josh Brolin, wasn't he in the Jonah Hex movie?
Yes, he was. He was Jonah
Hex. Which I didn't see.
Yeah, I didn't see it either. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
There's a few comic movies I have not seen, believe
That's
it or not. That is one
seen.
Of them. I haven't seen it.
As a rule, I usually go see every comic.
Yeah, everyone.
Even if it's something I know I'm not going to like, what's his name there? The Daredevil films.
Yeah, I saw that. Didn't hate it as much as everybody else either. But, you know, the superhero movies, I still think they're making great ones. The newest X-Men might be the greatest X-related one ever, in my opinion.
Yeah, I got to see that
and,
one.
And... I saw The Amazing Spider-Man recently, the first one, because I didn't see it, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Yeah, emo Peter Parker.
Didn't like it that much.
Goth Peter Parker.
A lot of people think he's a better Peter Parker, but I didn't like the movie that much. I mean, I guess I kind of just liked seeing, you know, Emma Watson, you know, doing her thing, but... The movie I didn't think was that good. A lot of my friends were telling how great Amazing Spider-Man was versus the first Spider-Man. I'm like, I don't think so.
First of all, Sam Raimi directing.
Yeah.
And what's his name there? The kid. The kid.
Oh, God, terrible. We're terrible at remembering people's names sometimes. But, yeah, the original Spider-Man, trilogy Spider-Man.
That was perfect, I thought.
Except for the third one.
The third one was the first two.
Willem
Dafoe was in
absolutely.
It. James Franco was in it. You know,
I enjoyed the hell out of the first two, But I think, I don't know why everyone's going on about the new one so much, and they're saying the second one is great. Those trailers look terrible.
Yeah, they don't look very interesting.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't like it.
Tobey Maguire. He's more my guy than Andrew Garfield. I'm sorry, man.
He just looks like what I would think Peter Parker will look like.
Yeah.
Like his vibe, he's just kind of like, you know, kind of nerdy, like bookish sort of dude, you know? Tobey Maguire in real life is probably a total animal.
Right, like, yeah.
In the film.
An animal, exactly.
You know.
But, you know, I don't know. Maybe I am going to see the second one. It's coming out soon, I would say, on video. I'm going to check it out. But the love for this first one that everybody has, is I don't have it. I don't really have it. I think Maguire was better.
You know, I think Josh Brolin is in the new Sin City.
Yes, he is. So cool.
That's going to be good.
9 friggin' years it's been since that first movie, man. I saw that first one in the theater. I love the hell out of it. Love the Frank Miller books. Can't wait for this new one.
I wish Frank Miller would write more comics.
Well, I hear the man does a lot of partying, so maybe he has to put down the partying and you know, get back to writing. I don't know.
Yeah, that's why I was holding on to that Marv, you know, figure
yeah.
He has
a classic Marv figure. Before the movie, in the mid-late 90s, there was a Sin City toy run, and that's where this guy came from.
Yeah, I got it. Still in its box.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, I was looking to sell it recently because I was trying to liquidate the
collection.
Mass of stuff I have in this room.
Yes.
And just stuff that, you know, I love it, but I'm like, what am I really going to do with this? You know what I mean? Like, I've had it in that packaging for like almost 20 years at this point.
Oh,
and,
God.
Yeah. Someone else will enjoy it. But now that I know that there's another film coming out, I'm going to hang on to it, for a little while. Maybe I'll get a little bit more value.
You got it. Yes, it ups it.
You know.
But, superhero movies, I loved The Wolverine. I really liked it. Did you like The Wolverine?
You know what? I'm afraid to see it because it actually covers one of my favorite storylines.
See it. It's
okay.
It's way better than X-Men Origins Wolverine. And it's actually, at certain points of it, I felt like I was not even watching a superhero movie. I felt like I was watching just like a drama action movie.
Well, that's kind of that short story, the miniseries that was based on that came out in the 80s.
Yep.
That very much was almost like, you know, like a Chow Yun-Fat style.
Yeah,
like,
no.
Yeah,
and
John Woo
I
film.
In my opinion, this movie carries that, you know, vibe.
Yeah.
I really liked it. I thought it was a lot
of, like, I love, that's my favorite Wolverine
story.
A
lot of violence. It's pretty damn heavy PG-13 movie on the violence.
I'm on it then.
Yeah,
that's
check
my
it
next
out.
Assignment is watching that film. My next goal.
Well, which brings us to our third and final film to cover in this installment of Necromaniacs, a movie that has never come out called The Poughkeepsie Tapes.
Yeah, we watched this on YouTube actually.
Yep, that is the only place to watch it. There's no DVD. There's no Blu-ray. There's no release date in sight. It is not coming out.
And you were saying, didn't MGM own this film?
Yeah. Here's the thing. This was a movie, if you were a horror person of the last decade or even a Fangoria reader of the last, 5 to 8 years, they had talked about this movie a long time ago, 2006, 2007. There was a trailer for this movie in 2007. And it was in the coming soon section in Fangoria magazine for about 5 years. The Poughkeepsie tapes. Basically, I mean, and this is something I'm going to read from another source. If you did a quick search for the film on the internet, you get a bunch of question marks, bunch of forum question mark threads. Where is this movie? What happened to this movie? It actually was shown in Tribeca in 2007, and that's where MGM picked it up. They slated the film for a general wide release, and then pulled it about 5 weeks before it was supposed to come out in 2007.
No explanation?
No, not at the time. There was no official explanation. Apparently, there was some money issues, and I think they were looking for another Blair Witch, basically. And this is, you know, in between the time of when there was those found footage films, and then there kind of wasn't for a while, and they kind of came back again. In 2007, it was kind of nothing really like that out there again just yet.
Well, what's interesting about that is John Dowdle, the writer. The director, writer and director of this film. Actually, there's brothers, John and Eric.
Two
brothers.
Yes.
One of those guys went on to, do the screenplay for Quarantine 1 and 2?
Yeah, well, he directed Quarantine 1 and 2, and he also directed Devil, all of which, after the fact of making this movie. This movie was made around 2005, 2006. MGM, as it turns out, still owns the rights to this movie. And have offered other studios the right to buy it, but no go. It's not people saying it might not be culturally relevant anymore. You know, the found footage thing is kind of, you know.
They still make found footage, though.
Yeah, no, I know. But the thing is, let's be honest. There was a second release date in 2009. It was supposed to be January 2nd, 2009. Never happened. I feel like this movie's brutal as hell. Let's get to the point here.
It's disturbing.
It is a disturbing, low-budgeted, mind you.
Very low budget.
Some very poor acting going on in this movie. I mean, I can't see this at a damn regular theater in my head. No. Like, I do not see this hitting a theater. No. Absolutely not.
I mean, you know, even amidst all the found footage films, like, that they're out there, this is still way deeper, and works on a way deeper psychological level.
And it kind of stays with you, actually. Yeah. You know, I think maybe MGM were probably excited at first and, you know, thought they might have had something interesting on their hands. And the trailer is pretty cool. There's a 2007 trailer on YouTube. It's, you know, 2 minutes or whatever. I mean, you know, it looked really cool. It was, you know, people were like, holy shit, what is this movie? This looks like it's going to be insane. I think it was probably way too much for MGM.
Yeah.
I mean, and even when they tried to reissue it in 2009, and they were like, ooh, we can't fucking put this movie out. Like, it comes off as like a found footage / documentary. It's presented as a documentary, as a real documentary about a serial killer in Poughkeepsie who does not get, you know, remains at large, basically, and is never caught. But there are some very uncomfortable moments in the movie involving children. I mean, there's no children getting hurt, but there's lot of the footage you see is him talking to young kids.
Well, he snatches one young girl,
and there's like a thud off screen where he probably hits her in the head. I mean, it is a really messed up movie.
Yeah.
And I gotta tell you, it's if you go to YouTube now or whatever after you're done listening to the podcast or while you listen to the podcast, several people have it up in its entirety. The one I watched it under was one called The Poughkeepsie Taste, like I guess the first one that went up, right?
Probably their
got quite
channel.
A few views and quite a few, you know, all thumbs up. The ones I saw, and I had nothing but positive, like, you know, thumbs up, whatever, positive versus negative. There was no negatives on one of the ones I watched it on. I got to be honest. I can't believe MGM bought this movie. I don't know what they were thinking. Blair Witch is an anomaly, and Blair Witch is also a bloodless movie, and it is also, it's not a shockless movie, but it's there's nothing in Blair Witch that makes you want to take a shower after viewing it. You know what I'm saying? There's nothing. Yeah. It's scary, sure, and the ending is kind of cool.
The ending was scary.
Yeah, the ending is scary.
The movie didn't
right.
really do anything.
No,
for
me. It's somewhat like the vibe and the mood is there throughout it, but ultimately, the payoff is the ending, and it's a non-payoff if you really think about it, because you don't see a damn thing.
No.
This movie, well, you see everything.
Well, you don't really see a lot. There's a lot of similar implied, to Texas
right.
Chainsaw Massacre.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, when Leatherface puts that chick up on the hook, you think you swear you see the hook going to her back,
but you don't really see anything. No,
and that's kind of what this film is. Like, you feel the violence, and you feel like just the sleaze in the film, but you don't actually really see anything. There's like some really strong references.
It's not super gory. No. It is disturbing.
It's disturbing, though, yeah.
And it is not for everyone.
No.
This is not a movie for everyone at all. It is definitely up my alley and Mike's alley. We like these kind of, you know, bizarre, fucked up, messed up movies. And I know, you know, many other people do as well. But if they were looking for some type of hit, some type of, like, we don't know if this is real or fake hit, this is not that movie. I mean, it's so strange. I was trying to maybe find something online from John Eric Dowdle, the director, where maybe he kind of gives a little more info about it or about what happened, and there isn't.
No, there's
so
nothing.
That kind of makes it even cooler in a way, actually. Because
yeah.
This guy is a working director in Hollywood right now.
Yeah, he's done a lot of
He did both
films.
Quarantines. He did Devil. He's got a new movie coming out this fall, As Above, So Below. You know, he partnered with M. Night Shyamalan. I mean, he's done a lot post this film. But I would say most of the people working with him have never even seen this movie. Like, it's completely unavailable. It's rare that a working director with some almost hits under his belt.
Yeah.
Quarantine did pretty well.
It did really well, yeah.
Has something so dark in his closet that it's like, it's not even available, you know? It's kind of cool.
But the thing is, though, it's dark, but compared to the work that he's done, I mean, we're in Quarantine, blatant ripoff.
It's Wreck.
The Spanish
Wreck. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which he never acknowledged, and that bummed me out.
Yeah.
That's the one thing about this guy that, like, I think is crummy, because Wreck is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I like it better than Quarantine.
No, it is a better movie. Quarantine's
and
not bad.
He never was like, you know what? You know, I'm heavily influenced by the Spanish film Wreck. It's the same fucking movie. And he never even mentioned the existence of that other film.
Yeah, I read a little bit about him. He's my age. He's 40 years old. He did Poughkeepsie Tapes with his brother, as you mentioned. His brother was the producer and co-writer. And, you know, you would think that this movie might have gotten at least a home, you know, video release.
Yeah.
No, nothing at all. It must have been interesting to see it in Tribeca in 2007, huh? Ooh. Wow. I mean, I know. If I had seen it, I would have told everybody I knew about it. I'm like, holy shit, this movie's crazy. It is filmed throughout Poughkeepsie and the...
Like Dutchess County, Putnam County, where I grew up, basically.
And again, it presents itself as factual, and I think it does somewhat of a good job in that respect. I mean, some of it, the acting is definitely iffy, and it's a little, you know, like B-movie, whatever. But the scenes of the killer where he's filming himself with some of the victims are really messed
up. It's intense, man.
Yes.
Very intense. Yes. And, you know, there's like... It really lingers on the psychological impact on the victims. And that's the thing that, more so than any of the implied violence, it's like the psychological impact that that they sort of, you know, underscore in this film. And that's kind of like what makes the movie really effective, you know.
Mm.
You know, and that was the creepiest part of the film, I thought.
And, you know, we could tell you a little more about it. There's one victim that he keeps alive throughout his years, and eventually kind of plays a cat and mouse game where the police are able to find her body, and she's alive.
Yeah.
And man, she's so messed up that it's like it's Stockholm Syndrome times 1,000.
Yep.
It's like, she keeps saying once she's home with her mom, she keeps saying, I want to go home. I want to go home. And she means home with the killer. It's like so disturbing.
Yeah, it's real disturbing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really what gets you. Because, I mean, you know, you and I, we've watched a lot of strong horror. But it's ultimately the really psychological stuff that gets to me. You know, not so much the gore and like the blood. That stuff I love because it's cool, you know. But the stuff that keeps me thinking is like the psychological stuff, you know.
Exactly. I like. Well, we saw a Serbian film in the theater in Brooklyn, a couple of years back.
Going back to Everything Went Black, number one.
Yes, oh my God! And you know, we were two of six people in the whole theater. And that movie, while it had the gore, it also had that mental cycle. It had a mental and psychological effect on you as well.
It had that creep factor.
It had the creep factor and the uneasy factor that stays with you. Absolutely. You know, but this movie, I mean, the biggest flaws are in maybe some of the dumb acting and maybe some of the overall like presentation of the clips and, you know, the acting by the fake police and the profilers and things like that. But otherwise, I think this is a good horror film, and I think it's a very disturbing movie that should be seen. I think a lot of real horror fans would probably enjoy this film.
Out of the three, it definitely gets the highest rating.
Yes,
for me, man.
A movie that you can't see, really. Yeah. And like we said, you can see it on YouTube. It's for free. You know, for free. Some of it is, most of the people hosting it on there have it in its entirety. A few have it kind of, chopped up into six parts or whatever, but don't bother with that. Just find the one where it says complete film. And yeah, a lot of the feedback is just like, wow, this is pretty great. It's pretty sick. Why didn't this come out? When is this coming out?
Well, that's the thing, man. Like a big studio like MGM is looking to make, you know, a lot of money on this.
Yeah, yeah. I don't see a lot of money being
made. No. But there's a huge audience for it, though. That's the thing. But the thing is, they almost probably think, well, all right, we don't have the man hours. Mm-hmm. The man hours we were put into making this DVD, we won't get back because there's only, like, you know, the X amount of people who want it. But, like, it would be in any other sort of situation, it would be a successful DVD or Blu-ray release. I mean, way more obscure films have gotten Blu-ray releases.
Well, going back, a movie I presented that we talk about that I have not seen yet, All the Boys Love Mandy Lane with Amber Heard, which was made in 2005 and came out on video last year. It sat on a shelf in a major studio. I can't remember which studio. And it just never came out. And it was another one of those ones that said, coming soon, to be released. All the Boys Love Mandy Lane. What the hell is this movie like? And turns out, according to reviews, it's a decent slasher movie. Like, it's not some amazing movie, but apparently it's pretty good, and it warranted its release, and I've heard it did pretty well on home video. I want to see it. You know, I like Amber Heard. She's Johnny Depp's current, I don't know if it's a fiance or his girlfriend, the one who, you know, very attractive blonde girl. Yes. I believe she is, or at least close to it.
Good.
Sometimes these things just happen. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what goes on at some studios where, and it's always a horror movie. I don't know if you noticed it. It's always like it's usually a horror movie that sits somewhere for a while and then it comes out.
Well, you know, the genre, it's like, I mean, you're probably working at one of these big studios is like working at a big corporation, you know, it's like, it really depends on who the project manager is. Like, if he's like, oh, you know, horror's dead. Yeah, I feel like we're not into this. We're going to shelve it. And just, it gets lost and filed away. And then they put out a rom-com or whatever the hell is like popular that year. And then like they forget about it. And then another guy takes over and he likes horror. And it's just like, or then stuff like this Poughkeepsie Tapes film just sort of languishes in like obscurity.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not worth it for anyone on that decision-making level to put it out. And it's, us fans suffer from that, you know.
The first Paranormal Activity, the one that came out in theaters, the one that was made for like 10 grand or whatever, initially the studio that bought that did not want it to come out in that form. They wanted that story to be redone with known actors.
Yeah.
And I think it was it Steven King? Somebody was just like, no, put it, no, I think Spielberg said, no, put it out just like this.
Yeah.
Just like, and like, really? It's like, who's going to see this? There's no names in it. It's very cheaply made. And look what that goddamn movie did. It made a fortune. It created a whole like series
sequels.
Of films and sequels. And they put it out as is. So sometimes the studios get it right, you know?
Yeah, because I guess that was like the demo of the movie. Like the demo version of the film, you know? And then they were like, well, no, we're going to release the demo, you
Let's just put it out just like this, yeah.
That, the woman in there, you know? Sort of like regular girl, you know?
Yeah, no. I think it was great. The first one's great, I think.
For a minute, I thought she was going to be naked in that movie. but it didn't pan out. Really?
Oh my god. Well, yeah, I mean,
it's a big part of horror films is nudity.
Of course. I was watching over the weekend The Burning. And which another one that for some reason did not hit DVD to 2007. It was never on DVD before 2007. Last year it got the deluxe treatment from Scream Factory, but this was the first 2007 version that is uncut that I watched. That movie was made in the wake of Friday the 13th in 1981, but has, I don't know, 50 times the nudity of the first Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
It has full frontal nudity from three of the girls, the high school girls, so to speak, in the movie. It's good. It's good, fun summer horror movie. Check it out if you haven't seen it, The Burning. It is not as good as Friday the 13th.
No, no, no.
It is not. Some
people
still, say
it's better. It's not too shabby, though.
It's not shabby. No, it's not shabby. And it's one of the first, you know, I think second or third Tom Savini effects movies that he did. He said no to Friday the 13th 2 so that he could do this movie. He did Maniac and Friday the 13th and then Burning. So, yeah.
Maybe he saw some potential.
Yeah,
there,
exactly,
you know?
Exactly. And it's Jason Alexander's from Seinfeld, his first thing he ever did.
Oh.
It's and he sounds exactly like George Costanza as a young man. It's pretty funny.
There's a ton of those like 80s films, you know, like The Prowler. That's mm-hmm. like another one
yes.
I really dug.
That actually might even be better than Burning, in my
that's
opinion.
That's a solid one.
It is solid. It's a little more deeper and darker.
Yeah.
Burning is pretty dark, but watching again with some distance, I'm like, nah, Friday the 13th's way better. As far as the nudity goes, yeah, it's like Friday the 13th movies had some nudity, but The Burning has a ton of nudity. You should check it out again. Very surprising the amount of nudity in it.
There's did you see ever see a film called The Beast Within?
A very long time ago I saw it, but I could not tell you much about it right now. I remember it, though.
It's a good one.
Yes.
Now I'm on that.
Also
80s.
From the early 80s, yes.
Yeah, 80s, Extro.
That's a sick movie.
Extro is intense.
That's something to seek out, kids. Extro. X-T-R-O. Is that is it British?
I believe it's British.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was, you know, back in the day when we were kids, we would go to the video store and rent movies from the horror section, and it was generally whatever had the best box cover. That had a pretty cool box cover, I remember.
Yeah, it had the creature.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's like a sci-fi, science fiction, horror, mm-hmm. horror,
yep.
rape movie.
Yeah,
you know, there's like a rape in the very beginning. You know?
Yes.
And like that's a big component in the 80s, was like, you know, rape and...
The Entity. That's
yes,
another one. The brutal rape scene in that movie.
Yep.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And the sun is like there for some of it.
Yeah.
And it's weird.
It's creepy.
Movie. Great movie, though. Entity. Yeah.
Yeah. In general, sex with underage girls, I think, was a very big theme.
Absolutely, because...
In the 80s.
In the 80s, yeah.
In general. Like, even, like, in metal songs. Like,
yeah.
You remember Kip Winger? She's only 17.
True,
Her
true.
Daddy like says she's too old, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
it's like she's young
I
enough
I guess
for me.
It was something that was frowned upon back then. I don't know. But if you think about it, like, as I was watching, I was thinking, I was like, why did teenagers look 30 years old in these damn 80s movies, and they're supposed to be like sophomores in high school? It was the strangest thing in the early 80s. The early 80s and the 70s are very close. It's almost like it's almost like the 80s didn't begin till like 84. Because 81 to 83, it looks like the freaking 70s to me, as far as some of the looks and the hairstyle. It, like, the 80s didn't kick in until about, like, 84, in my opinion. I mean, it's very hard to pinpoint a 78 movie and an 81 movie. Good luck.
Well, even, like, you know, now this is, like, the non-horror films, but, like, Fast Times at Ridgemont High and,
that's 83.
You know, Last American Virgin.
84,
they still have,
yeah.
They kind of have like a 70s trip.
They
going on.
Do. They do. Yeah. I mean, you know, of course, The Last American Virgin, the only teen sex comedy with a serious bum out ending.
Yeah.
Great ending.
Yep.
I don't even want to tell you the ending because some people have not seen that movie. I'm learning a lot of people haven't seen it, or they know the name and they think they've seen it. But see the movie. The ending has made some people I know tear up. It's so depressing.
Yeah. The girl in that movie reminded me of this girl I had a huge crush on when I was in middle school. She was just a couple years older than me.
Ah.
And, you know, I fantasized about her all the time. And she looked like, you know, my, like, young, you know, prepubescent, dirty mind, you know, like... So forming all these like scenarios,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it looked like the girl that was in that movie.
Uh huh. The Heartbreaker Girl,
the one who, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I'm not going to reveal too much.
No, yeah. See,
it's funny that we care about spoiling this film.
Yes, believe it or not,
but we don't give
a
fuck about spoiling the other movies.
Because it's the reason everybody still talks about Last American Virgin, that goddamn ending.
Yeah,
it's the reason that separates it from every movie of that era. You know, so a movie that is definitely. No trace of 70s. It's 80s. It's 85. The Goonies. It was on TV the other day. I was watching it. A good chunk of that movie is working actors today. A lot of people in that movie are you know,
we got
Sean Astin,
Josh
Brolin, Corey Feldman. I mean, it's debatable how much of a working actor he is, but he is in movies,
yeah.
And he is working.
Sure.
And there's talk of a 30 years later follow up for next year with, you know, almost everyone attached. So that God knows what that's going to be like.
Hey, let me ask you a question. And have you seen there was a series that was on MTV called Death Valley? Now, anyone out there that might be listening to this, if you've seen this, please, you know, contact us and we'll talk about this, because it's an excellent sort of comedy horror. Like, no one knows about it.
When was it on?
Oh, dude, I don't know, a few years ago. I think it's on Netflix, actually. Or it was on Netflix.
Oh, you're talking about the recent past?
Yeah.
Death Valley.
Yeah, it has Brian Callen was in it, the comedian. Brian Callen.
Now, it was like an hour long. Oh, Death Valley, 2011.
Yeah. It's, if anyone out there, I don't know, if they ended the season, and there was never a second season, but it was a sort of open ended. You know, definitely you needed more. And if anyone, you know, there's no plans of making another season.
It said, a mockumentary following a police force as they deal with various perpetrators who are most likely supernatural in nature.
They are.
This was in 2011.
Yeah.
I remember a lot about 2011. I do not remember this.
Exactly. Because it was on MTV. If it was on like a real like channel that people watched for, you know, that were above 12.
I have a question. How did you come about watching this?
You know, I can't even tell you how I fucking found it. I think I saw it. I think it's just one of those things that popped up on my Netflix suggestions. And I was like, Death Valley. It sounds like something I would be totally into. Just the title grabbed me. Wow. And I was like, oh, this sounds interesting, man. And it was good. It's like vampires, you know, werewolves. It takes place in L.A.
Interesting.
You know, it's funny, but there's also a dark element to it.
Well, I'm reading, you know, I'm a big fan of the IMDb message boards at the bottom of every movie. And one of them is, sure enough, how did I miss this? Like, singing its praises. So another one is like, somebody pick this up for a season two.
It's a real
This show is begging for a Kickstarter campaign.
Hell yeah.
So Mike Hill, this is a nice little surprise.
It's a very, very tragic demise of an excellent series.
Please make a second season.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the guy, Rob Zombie's brother. This is the thing that fucks me up.
Okay.
Rob Zombie's brother is the guy, it's his brainchild. The guy who was in Power Man 5000.
Okay. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Now, I think Rob Zombie can't make a fucking film to save his life.
I know. We disagree there.
I did like his last one. The
Lords of Salem.
Lords of Salem was great.
I'm finding me, Mike, and one other dude are the three people on the planet who thought it was a pretty good movie, but continue.
I liked it because it was like, you know, it wasn't that redneck, you know,
it was a total step away from all of his other movies.
Yeah, it was like a European horror.
It was
horror
very film. European.
Yeah.
It was trippy. It was a lot of the scenes you didn't know what the hell's going on. And I sometimes like watching movies like that.
It's like an Argento film.
Yes, it's more almost like a Jean Roland film. Or, you know, Jess Franco film meets an Argento film. It was very, like, you could see he was trying to do something that completely separated from the hillbilly, Devil's Rejects kind of stuff.
That's
and
tired.
It definitely did.
That's tired. That whole genre is tired that he does. But the thing is, it's funny. It's like, you would think that his brother would be like, hey, little brother, let me help you out. You know, like, I got millions of dollars. Let's do this, you know?
Right.
Because that concept he has, it's like way interesting. It's fun, and there's like stuff in it that's, it's like,
well,
it's not just a straight
horror.
It's got
a little file. It's got a cult following, according to IMDb.
Would throw my money down.
Interesting.
For that. If I had millions of dollars, I would back it. I think it's great.
Wow.
Do me a favor.
Death Valley. I have to check it out now.
Check it out. It's really, really good. I blazed right through all the whole season. And I was like, I can't believe it's over. I can't believe it ended like this.
And is it played straight? Is it like,
it's played straight, and there is a comedy element to it. But it doesn't detract from how cool it is.
Okay.
It makes it cooler, actually.
Death Valley.
You know? All right. It's like, you know, there's werewolves, there's vampires, there's like demons, there's all this, like, and it's like I said, there's like a, it says in the description, it's like a special unit in LAPD who deals with like paranormal.
I like the plot.
It's a great, great plot.
This is making me think that for each podcast towards the end, we both come up with something we've something you've never seen, so to speak.
Yeah, totally, man.
Something to check out that you've never seen, and this book definitely classifies that.
Oh, hell yeah, man.
I have no recollection of this at all. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, definitely, if you're out there, I don't know if it's still on Netflix.
I think it is, according to the post. Good.
Because if it's not on Netflix, you're never going to find it.
Wow.
Because it doesn't exist unless it's on Netflix.
Amazing.
Yeah, and that, man, I enjoyed the hell out of it. I thought, you know, do me a favor. This weekend, you know, put aside a few hours, you know, put on the AC, get a pizza, and watch this whole series.
I'm checking it out.
Yeah. What do you think? Did you watch Hemlock Grove?
I only watched the first episode, and I liked it. Another friend of mine told me to go back to it, and I know you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to it because now the second season is starting. I just have to find the time in my ridiculously busy life sometimes. But I definitely want to check that out. And I know True Blood is somewhat in the horror canon. I watched the first 5 seasons. I missed the entire last season. And now this current one is the very last one. And I kind of told myself that I was going to find some time to watch that one season I missed. But I think Death Valley is now going to take precedent.
Dude,
and I'm going to watch that.
For sure, Death Valley takes precedent over... I didn't enjoy True Blood.
You didn't enjoy True Blood at all. Yeah. It's a lot of people only like the first 2 seasons or whatever.
I only like the first, like, 10 minutes of the first episode, man. Like, when that dude rolls up in the liquor store or whatever, it's like, there's, like, some, like... real tension there.
Yeah, no, I think those first episodes are very good.
Yeah.
But one little thing I can throw a plug to is the new HBO show, The Leftovers. I must say, 2 episodes in, I am in there, man. I am hooked.
Yeah.
I think this is a cool-ass show. The first episode did about 1.8 million viewers, which is pretty nice. I think they were expecting it to do a little better, but I think those numbers are quite respectable for a brand new show that a lot of people are still going, what the hell is this
thing? Exactly. And it's not like they know what the hell it's
exactly.
about.
Exactly.
You know, so.
You know, Justin Theroux, I like him, good actor, and a lot of stuff that I've liked. Liv Tyler, I like her. Amy Brandman, I like her. Great cast. So far, so good. I mean, there's only so much to really even say in the first 2 episodes. But the whole plot line is, what if 2% of the world's population has just up and disappeared out of nowhere with no rhyme or reason as to who it was? Good people, bad people, you know, young people, old people, just disappeared. And this movie deals with what life is like in what appears to be, almost looks like a Westchester town in New York, what the life is like there 3 years later and how everyone's dealing with it. And this little cult has formed in the wake of it called the Guilty Remnants. They all wear white and smoke cigarettes and don't talk. It's crazy. But I think it's freaking awesome. And has a slight horror side to it. Not much of a horror side.
Yeah, it's dark.
It's dark.
Yeah.
It's from Damien Lindelof from Lost, who also has a comic book background. He did the Ultimate Hulk Wolverine. That was his. You know... And also the guy from Friday Night Lights is
a
producer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I really dig it. I mean, it's only 2 episodes in.
Yeah.
But, you know, not like True Detective. It's not, you know, you're not going to be like, I don't think you're going to get your ass knocked off your seat so much so as if True Detective's first few episodes.
It's definitely more subtle than
that. Yes, it's more subtle, but I can't wait to see where it goes.
Yeah. Yeah, there's more of like a plot development, like character development, and like, but you can tell there's like some kind of dark thing going on, some dark element going on, and
there's a guy who's shooting all the dogs around town, and you don't know why he's doing it till the very end of the first episode, and I thought the reason was to what happened, why the dogs went wild was kind of cool. It was like all the dogs that witnessed their people disappearing, and how these dogs just kind of lost, like, went rabid because of what they saw. And no one really knows what they saw. Because there's one cutaway in the very beginning of the first episode of a baby disappearing. We don't see the baby disappear, but we see the baby in the backseat crying. We go to the mom. The crying stops. The mom turns around. The baby's gone. But according to this guy in the town, these are all the dogs in the town who witnessed their masters go, and it made them nuts. I think that was a great
explanation. That's great. Yeah. I think like also this is clearly there's like a supernatural.
Oh going on. Yeah,
it's not like as much as I love True Detective. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like. Wow, is there really a Carcosa? Like
you flirted with supernatural, and it teased it.
But by definition, this is a paranormal story.
Yes, exactly.
So
exactly.
You know that right, the end, right. You know, whatever, like you know, reveal is going to have some sort of supernatural element.
The cool
to it.
Thing about True Detective is everyone was convinced there was going to be a supernatural, like there was going to be some like monster
King.
Or like, oh, absolutely. But there wasn't. And I thought that was great that there wasn't.
Totally. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But by definition, what's going on in Leftovers is is paranormal.
Yeah.
Supernatural
kind
of vibe to
it's like, I mean, you know, it's from a book, based on a book.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you have a Leftovers. And, you know, I kind of want to read the book, but I kind of don't. I kind of don't want to know, you know, I kind of want to be surprised.
Yeah, I'll after the first season, I'll probably seek the book out, you know. But yeah, man. I mean, that's you know,
that's it, man. That's
pretty much
we talked about a lot of stuff.
You know.
But basically, World War Z. I would say, yeah, check it out.
Yeah. Especially now that it's on Netflix.
Exactly. It's not as bad as maybe some of your friends said. Not as great as some of your friends said either. Old Boy remake. You don't need to see it. See the original.
Avoid it.
And Poughkeepsie Tapes, we both give the thumbs up to and recommend for the horror maniacs out there. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, man. That gets five flaming skulls, man.
Yes, five skulls.
Five exactly. bloody skulls.
We give it the five skull review and you know, a hidden gem out there, I feel like.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's one of those movies that I kept hearing about, too, man, like you.
The build-up,
you know,
yeah.
People would talk
there.
About it. It's like one of these.
And
like,
it's more sicker than I thought it was going to be. But again, without, you know, being drenched in gore or anything like that. But, you know, it's just in a different way sick.
I think that if it had been drenched in gore, it would have actually taken away from the disturbing elements.
Because if it did come out, it would have been around the time of Hostel and all those movies. And it's really nothing like those movies. You know, it kind of might have been lost in the shuffle.
And also, I think that, like, super graphic, you know, bloody gore films become a different category than the sort of psychological films. And
right.
Though, I mean, you know, I love gore and all that stuff. The bloodier, the better. I love all that stuff. But I also, the ones that really stay with me, though, are the ones that are more subtle and there's like sort of like a psychological element to it.
Inside, Martyrs,
yeah,
etc. The French movies were a few years ago,
Martyrs,
which have still yet to be topped.
Yeah. Martyrs, there's a pretty decent amount of gore.
Oh yeah, let's be
but,
honest.
But it's still, it's,
yeah,
it that that's a fucking tour de force.
Yeah,
though,
that
we should talk about that one.
We should talk about that one. However, I'm going to tease that we have decided for our next one, we're going to finally talk about Dracula, and we're going to talk about 1992's Bram Stoker's Dracula, and something we're a little nervous about, 2013's Dario Argento's Dracula in 3D. Well, I don't know, man. It's heartbreaking. As such an Argento fan as I am, man, the new movies just really kind of make me uncomfortable.
They look bad too, man.
Not even the damn trailers look good. Yeah. I don't know. I was telling a friend, it's like it's almost as if the man who made Tenebrae, Deep Red, Suspiria, and Opera, and the man that exists today are not the same man. I don't know. Maybe he's not. Maybe someone kidnapped him.
Like,
I don't know.
Kidnapped him. They put like a pod person. There.
Yes, I don't know. I mean. You know, some could say the same about the, Wes Craven and John Carpenter movies as well. But, hey, you know, we're not talking about them yet. We're going to talk a little more about Dario next week and about a movie that it never ceases to amaze me, the amount of people that did enjoy Francis Ford Coppola's 1992 Bram Stoker's Dracula. I have a tattoo of it.
I love it.
And I am at a checkout counter in Bay Ridge, and this girl ringing me up, normal girl, sees the tattoo and goes, oh my god, I love that movie with Keanu Reeves and Gary Oldman. And I went, you get it. I was like, you have good taste.
There's that new Dracula film that looks actually pretty good, man.
Which one?
There's like a trailer out. It's Vlad the Impaler.
Yeah, yeah, it takes off. It's from that angle of it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I want to kind of check that out too.
Yeah,
actually.
It's interesting. It's like Game of Thrones meets Dracula.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. I did see.
Yeah, I put something up on. Oh, and by the way, we now have a Facebook page.
Yes.
If anyone gives, you know, wants
that's
to check
right.
that out.
Facebook.com/Necromaniacs Podcast. One word. It just went up last night. You can like it, and you can tell us, you know, what you think about stuff, or. Yeah. Whatnot, or send us a message to tell us how angry you get that we can't remember certain people's names. You know, things like that.
Yeah, man. Yeah, hey, you know, this is all for free, man. What do you
exactly.
expect?
Exactly. Come on now. Yeah. We're just two guys. We're not, you know, we don't have magazine articles anywhere about film. We don't have film degrees. We're just film fans, and we like talking about the movies we
absolutely.
Like and the movies we don't like.
Yeah. You got to mix the good with the bad.
Exactly.
You know.
And, you know, you know, it's primarily horror, you know, but we will do sci-fi, we'll do a comic movie, we'll do, you know, anything in the umbrella, you know, of genre film. Might do a you know, spaghetti western,
yeah.
giallo film, you know, so.
Something like Cruising.
Yes, a movie like Cruising, the Al Pacino's Dark Secret film.
Yeah. Wow, he doesn't, what's that, what do you mean?
Oh, a little quick thing about that, he actually did talk a little bit about it in a newish Pacino biography, finally.
Okay.
He talks about it, and there was, I think, in some other magazine interview where he actually had some more nicer things to say about it, finally.
That movie's a masterpiece.
It took him a long time to warm up. It is a masterpiece, and it is like, you don't know who the killer is, and it's great. It's so crazy. I mean,
it's an American gay
giallo. Absolutely, absolutely. Down to the music,
yeah.
down to the look,
to the gloves, and everything.
It's, oh my god, it's a brilliant movie, and it is on DVD. Check it out. William Friedkin's Cruisin'. If you're very hung up on homosexuality, no, you probably shouldn't see this movie. But, you know, yeah. if you like good movies, see this movie. How do you like
and
that?
If you're hung up on homosexuality, man, you just got to get over it.
Though. Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's the 21st century.
Come on. I know. And the other thing is, what's his name from the original? Oh, James Franco shot a... What he called that lost scene of Cruising, he shot it, I heard. I don't know who was actually seeing... I don't know if you can see this footage anywhere, but he so liked that movie and was kind of inspired by it that he did a short that is like very much like the club scenes in
wow.
that. And I don't think it's even available to like the general public. I'm going to do some research about that. Apparently... He's a big fan of that movie.
If you find it, we should post it on our link.
Yeah, and I tell you,
Facebook.
You know, people would laugh about the idea of a Cruisin' remake, but if you ask me, someone like him could probably, you know, make that happen.
Yeah, definitely, man.
You know,
also, one of my favorite actors, Joe Spinell, is in Cruisin'.
You know, everyone talks about, you know, how messed up whatever that movie is and whatnot. It has some cool character actors in it. Joe Spinell is one of them. Joe Spinell, of course, the star of Maniac, and fantastic minor roles in Godfather and Rocky. Come on. Those are cool roles
yeah,
in those
man.
Movies.
He pops up in a lot of places.
Oh, my God. Such a cool resume. I mean, really.
About maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was watching a John Milius film called mm-hmm. Big Wednesday. It's a surfing movie.
Hmm.
Okay. And Joe Spinell had a small part in it.
What?
He played a doctor. Yeah, like a military doctor at the end of the film.
Oh,
I'm like,
God.
I had to do a double take because I'm like, that motherfucker shows up everywhere, man.
No one else made me do a double take. In one of the documentaries on one of the Maniac discs, Mike Ness shows up.
Yes, that's
yes,
right.
Yes,
yep,
yes
I
that's
remember
right.
that. Yep.
Mike Ness of Shoals of Distortion, well, I think we've mentioned this before, pops up on the streets of California hanging out or whatever with Joe Spinell in his 20s back then, obviously.
Yeah.
Mike Ness. It's pretty weird.
Well, everyone out there in podcast land, thank you for tuning in.
Yes, thanks for listening, for the support.
And, you know, if you're in the market, try out some new coffee. Check out SavageGoldCoffee.com.
And also check out the fucking great new Tombs record, Savage Gold, which is fucking awesome. And you should have it already. If get it now, get it right now. The minute you're done hearing this, and get the new Tombs record. It's fucking great, Mike.
And then you know, The Last Stand's got some gigs.
Yes,
coming up too.
Check us out. Damn it, we have a record out called The Time Is Now. You can check that out too.
All right, have a great evening, guys.
Later.
Take care.